Good morning. How's everybody doing today? Everybody's okay? Yeah, awake? Awake? Caffeinated? All the above? Half of the above? Ready to take a nap? That's okay. I'm glad you're here. So I'm Chris. I'm the pastor here at Table Life. So it's great to have you here with us today. And hopefully we got a little taste of spring slash summer earlier this week. Anybody have your like tank top on, your flip-flops out, whatever? And then sure enough, just like that, we didn't quite get snow, but we were close to it. And eventually the weather shall change. We just kind of sang of that in some of the verses this morning. Winter turns to spring eventually. So I'm glad you're here this morning. Well, we are in this series called 24 Hours. That is our Lenten series. So if you didn't know that Lent is traditionally the season leading up until Easter, a season of preparation that Christians have participated in over the centuries. A time of introspection, of looking inside ourselves, asking how God is calling us to change, to grow, to examine our own hearts as we really focus on who Jesus is and what he has done for us. So I want to start off today. Today's week four in our series titled The Trial. If you have your sermon notes in Worship Guide, there's sermon notes that's printed there if you're online. It's under resources on our website. If you do like to take notes or print those out, always good to do that for our note taker folks. But in week four, I want to start off with a question for you. Who is your favorite villain? Okay, yeah? Yeah, you can like answer that? Yeah. Who is your favorite villain? Anybody have a favorite villain? Like, talking like Disney, like movies, like anything. So, yeah. Nate, you want to put that picture up on the screen there? Any of those kind of stir some thoughts, memories, right? We have like Cruella De Vil. Anybody? Like, okay. Anybody? Okay. No. Anybody else? Who's your favorite villain? Vader. Yes. Darth Vader. Okay. Star Wars people. Darth Vader. Yes. Okay. What another favorite villain? Anybody? Scar, okay, Lion King, right? Yeah, classic there. There's a bunch of them on the screen. I want you to think, okay, so whoever your favorite villain is, if not, you don't have a favorite, if you're like, that's a weird question, Pastor Chris, like, just look up on the screen. I want you to answer, what traits and actions characterize a villain? What traits and actions tend to characterize a villain? What would you say to that? How do you know a villain? What was that?
Evil.
Evil, yes. And evil, villains are evil. They're equated with evil, right? Anything else? What kind of comes to mind? What was that in the back? They don't have a conscience. Oh, they don't have a conscience. Okay, that's good. Yeah, Dave? They're deceptive. They're evil. They don't have a conscience. They're scheming. I like that. That's scheming. Yes, you know, especially like, well, greedy, yes, greedy. Just like all these kind of like very like negative feelings and whatnot. As we kind of think, anybody want to add to that?
Self-serving,
self-centered, self-motivated. Say something. Vengeful, yes. Yeah, wanting revenge. Yeah, a lot of the stories that we tend to watch, they're about revenge or that the evil one wants to get back. And it's interesting because in fiction, right, like these are made up stories, all these people, faces on the screen. In fiction, it's very easy to have very clear-cut villains, isn't it? Like they tend to like wear darker colors. They tend to be in the darkness, like scheming along, especially like in Disney, right? It's like always along those lines. But in real life, it's not so much the case. In real life, it's not so much the case. So in this series, we've been talking about the last 24 hours of Jesus's life, and we've been going through the Gospel of Mark specifically in that. And if you go back and read these stories, which I encourage you to do, by the way, even through this series, go back and kind of refresh yourself as we're making our way through the Lenten season. But when you go back and read these stories, you'll find that they're not really easy stories, right? I mean, the last couple weeks have been pretty hard stuff. And we're going to get to even harder stuff, by the way, today. And you can kind of see why often in churches, they don't really focus on these stories or preach about them very often, because we tend to come to church, right, to feel uplifted and be encouraged. But I think that there's something really, really important, especially in this season, that we need to go to these stories and look at them. That if we're to experience the true hope and joy of Easter, of the resurrection, we have to embrace the difficult journey to get there. So today we're going to look at someone, and maybe someone's if you want to look at the whole crowd here, but we're going to look at someone who could be considered the villain of the story of Jesus, the villain. But I want to give a little warning because I think it's more complex and complicated than you think. And instead of being like this dark, deceptive, evil person, how this person is a lot more like you and me than we realize. It's someone who doesn't just do bad things. And so while today the story is going to be a challenging one, I think it does present and point us to some hope. So, but before we get there, I do want to refresh ourselves, like to just remind us of where we've been. So the last 24 hours of Jesus' life, we started off with this Last Supper with Jesus and his disciples, right? They're in this upper room. They're sharing the Passover supper, the Passover Seder together. Jesus shares some news, and he takes these symbols that were involved in that meal, the cup and the bread, and he uses them to point them to himself, saying, this is my body, which is broken for you. This is my blood, which is shed for you. And in the midst of that, he points and predicts that somebody in the midst of these disciples is going to betray him. Somebody's going to betray him. And not only that, but when the meal is over and they're ready to leave, he goes to Peter and he predicts that Peter is going to deny him three times. Peter, the most important disciple in like most of our book, right? Like for Jesus, like for Peter, he's like the leader. He's the guy that is the go-to. He's there, and Jesus predicts that he's going to deny him. And so they leave that upper room. They travel out to the Mount of Olives, and they go to this garden named what? Gethsemane to pray. And they're like, Gethsemane means oil press. Think about that symbolically, the oil press, how Jesus is pressed in this time. And it's where Jesus pours out his heart in prayer to God. And meanwhile, his disciples have fallen asleep. They're waiting for him, and he goes back three times and finds that they had fallen asleep. They're snoozing at that time. But then when Jesus is finished praying, he gets up with his disciples, and a man named Judas, one of the disciples, enters the scene. He shows up with the temple priests and the religious leaders who come to arrest Jesus, to take him away. And one of the disciples tries to protect Jesus, takes out the sword and like whaps off like one of the soldier's ear, the servant's ears. And Jesus is like, no, guys, we're not doing it this way. This is not the way to do this. And instead, Jesus is taken away to Caiaphas. To Caiaphas, the high priest. And at the high priest is where all the religious leaders are gathered. These are Jesus' own people. These are the people who are supposed to be closest to God. And they're trying to figure out a way to get Jesus murdered, to kill him. Think about that. They've been waiting for a Messiah for centuries. And they're like, this man, we got to get rid of him because he's taking away our power. He's kind of stirring things up. He's doing these miracles and all that. And so they're trying to get Jesus to be put to death. And after Caiaphas, he's taken to Pilate. And that's where we're going today. The story of Jesus' trial before Pilate. Now, different than Jesus' presence before Caiaphas, the high priest, the religious leaders, he's now entering into the Roman presence. The government leaders here. And often, you know, as we're kind of reading this, if you read this in Mark chapter 14 and 15, we often forget how rapidly all this happened, by the way. You know, like nowadays, if someone is arrested and tried and then a verdict is given, doesn't it? It takes years. It takes years for us to do that. But today, we look at Jesus's. This took place over the span of 12 hours. 12 hours. So imagine, Passover Seder till now. The time is now about 7 in the morning. So I want to read this whole story to you, starting in Mark chapter 15. I'll read it together, and then we'll kind of look back and unpack what took place. So Mark tells us, very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans. So they bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. Are you king of the Jews? Asked Pilate. You have said so, Jesus replied. The chief priests accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asked him, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they're accusing you of." But Jesus still made no reply, and Pilate was amazed. Now, it was the custom at the festival to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate, knowing it was out of self-interest that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead. "What shall I do then with the one you call the king of the Jews?" Pilate asked them. "Crucify him," they shouted. "Why? What crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Okay, so when we pay attention to this story, it's pretty interesting. You know, I say that because there's all these different groups of people who dislike or kind of like are unsure of Jesus, but none of them wants to be responsible for putting him to death, right? That they dislike him, they're unsure of him, but none wants to be responsible for putting him to death. And every time that I read this story, hear this story, especially around this time of year, I have to ask myself and put myself in the equation, what would I have done? You do that when you read scripture? It's a good thing to do. What would I have done? You know, all of us would have liked to think that surely we wouldn't have done those things. I wouldn't have been shouting in the crowd to crucify him. But when we dig a little deeper, we recognize that this story in particular isn't about a few people who did some very bad things. Instead, it's a story about a lot of decent people who failed to do the right thing. Think about that. Not about a few people who did bad things, but about some very decent people who failed to do the right thing. A different characterization of what we would usually think as a villain, right? I mean, first, let's look at the religious authorities. We talked about them a lot last week, but you know, it's ironic, right? I mean, they didn't have the power to execute Jesus, but they knew that the government did. So they were plotting and scheming and trying to get their way. And last week we talked about the fear that they had, how fear was the main motivation for them to want to get Jesus killed. They were losing control. They were fearful of what Jesus would do in their midst. And so finally, in the midst of their little trial, they concluded that Jesus was guilty of blasphemy, which of course wasn't a very important thing to the Romans, by the way, but it was to them as the religious. And ironically, they knew that Jesus had no intention at all of overthrowing Rome, so they had to get him in trouble some other way. See, if Jesus claimed to be king, that would be a different story, right? Because that would make him an insurrectionist. That would make him somebody going against Rome, putting himself in authority. That would be something that Rome definitely would be interested in and would be willing to put Jesus to death, but they had to get him to say it, right? They're manipulative, but they're doing it out of that sense of fear and protection for themselves. But you know what, friends? At any time along this whole story, they could have stopped the whole thing. They could have said, no, guys, like, I know you don't like Jesus. Maybe you don't think he's the Messiah, like, but maybe killing him isn't the right thing to do. Or maybe setting him up to be killed. Like, all it took that any time along this way, they could have stopped the whole thing. But they didn't. They didn't. So that's the religious authorities. Then we have the crowd, right? The second is the crowd. The crowd, they were notified of Jesus' arrest. So imagine this, the whole thing is usually taking place over the nighttime hours. So at some point, there were people who were notified of Jesus' arrest. And they followed him about a quarter mile to what was known as the Antonia Fortress, which was the governor's residence. It was a military garrison in the middle of the city. This is a drawing of what that would have looked like in Jerusalem. And you imagine that maybe among the people who were notified, who were kind of paying attention to what was going to happen to Jesus, maybe these were the people who lost their revenue in the temple when Jesus flipped over the tables. Maybe these were people that knew kind of what these religious leaders were trying to do and they wanted to pay attention. Maybe these were what we call, when we're driving on the highway, the rubberneckers, right? You see the accident, you're like, what happened over there? And everybody in your lane like slows down, like we're like intrigued by bad things happening to other people, right? That's what we do. But the thing is, this was probably not the crowd from Palm Sunday. This was not the crowd that we would say were the people that were waving the palm branches, because most of them would have been asleep at the hour. They just celebrated the Passover. They just eaten with their families. And once again, it was late by the time those meals were done. They probably would have been asleep the whole time this was going on. But for this group in the crowd who was there, cheering on for Jesus to be crucified, this group was the group who for them, they were looking for a Messiah who met their expectations. But Jesus didn't meet them. I mean, historically, at this time, there were probably about 8 to 13 Messiahs that had come, supposed Messiahs. People that had come and said, we are coming to save the Jews. We are coming to bring back power to Israel. We are coming to come and to overthrow the Roman government. And some of those 8 to 13 supposed Messiahs had dozens of followers. It's recorded that one of them actually had 6,000 followers. Think about that. A whole like army of people who believed that this was the one who was sent by God. This was the one who was sent by God to overthrow the government. And all of them used the sword for power. All of them were in some way using violence to bring about their way. But then we see Jesus is not doing that at all, right? I mean, think about that. Jesus went against everything the populace believed in. Like, he wasn't going to do any of that. They believed that freedom required force. That Jesus said, no, this is not the way. Instead, we are going to love our enemies. What, Jesus? Like, instead, we are going to, like, bless. What, Jesus? That didn't make them happy. And so we see this lived out when Pilate gives the crowd the choice, right? He gives them a choice that it was a tradition to release a prisoner at the time of the Passover. And Pilate gives them a choice to say, well, there's this guy named Barabbas. And yes, he was convicted. He was trying to like do some damage and overthrow the government. He's in prison down there in some cell. And you can choose him or Jesus to be set free. And we see, who does the crowd choose? Barabbas. They choose Barabbas. Ironically, his name is probably Jesus Barabbas, meaning son of the father. So think about this. Jesus, the name Jesus means savior. This was a choice between two messianic figures that the crowd had at the time. One leads by force. One says, we're going to win things back and get our power. We're going to reclaim our tax money that the government has taken from us. We're going to restore the wealth and the glory of the Jewish kingdom to its rightful place. But then the other leads by loving the same oppressors, by serving them and bringing peace. And you imagine, which one would you want freed? Which one do you want destroyed? That was the choice the crowd was making. We see, when we see that choice that way, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, it's not so difficult to understand the crowd's choice. Why would they choose Barabbas over Jesus? The choice of the power of strength and power and military might and lower taxes over the path of love and peace and doing it a different way. So that's the crowd. We see them. Are they villains? I don't know. I don't know in this story. It's kind of a mixed bag, isn't it? But then we move on to Pilate, right? You say, yeah, he's the bad guy. He's the villain here. But historically, we do know that he was the governor of Judea from the year 26 to 36 AD. And by this, we know that he is mentioned outside of the New Testament scriptures. He's mentioned by this guy named Philo, who was a Jewish philosopher. And he described Pilate as this. So get this. This is kind of cool. He says, he was a man of inflexible disposition. He was very harsh and very stubborn. That's the way he's described in that historical document. And another historian named Josephus at the time, from the first century, said that when Pilate met resistance to a project he had of creating an aqueduct, like for water in the city, that he plundered the temple, the Jewish temple, to fund it. So he stole from the Jewish people. And eventually, so the story goes that Pilate, who was eventually relieved of duties after Jesus in 36 AD. And you wanna know why? Because he slaughtered followers of a Samaritan who claimed to be a prophet. He just slaughtered them. And he got in trouble for it at that point. So, but you see this, this is not a man who was hesitant about killing anybody. He knew that the religious authorities were accusing Jesus out of envy. The scripture tells us that. But he was curious of Jesus. He had heard about him. He also knew that he was innocent. He knew that this man, while the religious people had a problem with him, he didn't, right? But also at the same time, he didn't want anybody to start a riot. He wanted to keep the peace in the country. In Matthew's story, version of the story, as Jesus is presented before Pilate, and all this is happening, and there's accusations going on. We see Matthew tells us this. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It is your responsibility." I mean, have you ever heard the phrase, like, to wash one's hands of the matter? Like, I'm washing my hands of this, right? It comes from here. It's from the Bible, yeah. And what does it mean? Well, basically, whatever happens next is not my responsibility. It's not my fault, not my problem. It's like a kind of a cop-out. It's a disclaimer. He came to the conclusion that there was nothing he could do. But when you think about it, right, he was the Roman emperor, or the Roman governor. He's like the most powerful person in the whole region. He had all the power of the empire at his back. He could have done whatever he wanted. Instead, what he did, he washed his hands of it all. He let it go. He was either too scared or too lazy, or he was too worried to do anything about it. And the same is the situation for everybody in this story, right? Anybody at any point had the power to end it, but they didn't. They didn't. Everyone in the story is more interested in having clean hands than having a clean heart. See, Jesus died taking on one of humanity's greatest sins, not because people did bad things, but decent people didn't do anything at all. So, and in the church, if you were brought up in the church, maybe you've heard this before, we've given a name to this sin. This is not like Pastor Chris's name. This is like over centuries of the church. We've given a name to this type of sin. It's called the sin of omission. Have anybody ever heard that before? The sin of omission. So if you did, it's contrasted with what we call the sin of commission. So a sin of commission is, with the C, is when we choose to do something wrong. We choose to do something hurtful. We choose to do something bad. We take action. We hurt someone. We kill someone. We threaten someone. We do those things that we do wrong. And let me give you a little example of this. There's a little story that goes that there was once a Sunday school teacher who was talking about sins of commission and omission, teaching her class. And when asked the difference, a little boy responded and said, "Sins of omission are those sins that we want to do, but we just haven't gotten around to do yet." So, well, he's kind of right. But a sin of omission is when we fail to do the right thing. So sin of commission means we do the wrong thing, but a sin of omission means not my problem. I'm not gonna get involved. I'm just gonna say nothing. I mean, that's what it's about. Sin isn't only the things that we do wrong, but it's also the things that we choose not to do right. And you know what I'm talking about, right? I mean, we've all been in situations when we should have said something and didn't. We have a sense of what we should do in the moment, but we let it pass. We get ourselves uninvolved when something gets messy, or we leave when something gets difficult. I mean, the religious leaders and the crowd and Pilate, they didn't necessarily do something wrong in this time. They didn't kill Jesus in this moment, but they failed to do what was right. You know, I was reading some articles about this and about, like, why do we do this? Why is there, like, a sin of omission? And I found that in psychology, there's a term for this. It's called the bystander effect. The bystander effect. And basically, there's two reasons why people fail to act. And there's two reasons. I want to kind of describe them to you just for a couple minutes here. The first is what's called pluralistic ignorance. Can you guys say that with me? Pluralistic ignorance. So you can go home and you can say, I learned some psychology in church today. But pluralistic ignorance means that we tend to go with the crowd. That when we're by ourselves, we're more inclined to act, to do something. But when we're in a crowd, if nobody else is doing anything, saying anything, we just like don't want to jump in and say anything. I mean, you think about like you go to Aunt Hilda's, right? For lunch after church, and the whole family's sitting around, and you see that in the corner there's a couple of cans of cat food, and they're open, and you know that she don't have a cat. And pretty soon you're eating a stew, right? And you're sitting there with your family, and she said, I tried a new recipe today, what do you think of it? And everybody's sitting eating Aunt Hilda's stew. And what does Dad say? This is what? Good, Aunt Hilda. And what does Johnny say? Cousin Johnny, he's like, yeah, Aunt Hilda probably could use a little spice, but I like it, right? And then you're sitting there looking at the Friskies, like holding your spoon, like, yeah, this is very original, right? You just kind of go along with it because it seems like everybody else is liking it. You don't want to be the person that's like, hey, she put cat food in the food here. You know, you don't want to do that. But like in a more, you know, and there's situations like, hey, you walk into a church, right? Maybe you're brand new and you grew up in a tradition that when you worship, right? You raise your hands, you are going like this, you're doing this, and you walk into church and everybody's like worshiping. Praise the Lord from whom all blessings flow, right? You look around, you're like, right? Immediately, you're like, I don't want to be the only one. Nobody else is, like, we want to, like, fit in that. And I want to encourage you, by the way, raise your hands and worship. Don't be, you can feel free to be the only one. Everybody else will kind of follow. But even along those lines, right? On a more serious level, like when you hear an off-color joke, but you're in the midst of a crowd, nobody says anything, so you don't. You know, that when somebody's gossiping and talking about her and talking about what she did, and say, oh yeah, yep, she did that, like, you don't want to be the one. Everybody else is there, and you just, like, you say nothing. You don't call out negative behavior in a big group. It's the reason why, like all you students, you know, if nobody else is raising their hand in class to ask a question, even though you have a question and probably everybody else does, you don't raise your hand, right? Because we don't want to do that. We don't want to look stupid. We're more concerned with not looking bad than doing right. That's pluralistic ignorance, is that we tend to go with the crowd. We don't want to be the only one, even if everybody else is thinking along the same lines. But the second reason is what's called diffusion of responsibility. Diffusion of responsibility. So kind of demonstrate this. I have a couple of people that I've asked to be a part of this. So Jake, you want to come up? Ben, Maddie, we're going to have a little improv here. They don't know what they're doing. They did volunteer to do it. So they're going to kind of demonstrate this. So, okay, so pluralistic ignorance was to go with the crowd. Diffusion of responsibility is to fail to act because we don't see it as our problem. To fail to act because we don't see it as our problem. So I'm going to give you guys a situation, and then I'm going to give you some instructions on what to do with it. So there is a weed in the church parking lot. So some of you are giggling because I think I mentioned this like last. There's a weed in the church parking lot. It started off that big, but pretty soon, by the next week, it's that big. And the next week, It's that big. We're calling this the growing weed in the church parking lot. And the conflict is that every character here must acknowledge the problem, but rationalize why they aren't the one to fix it. Okay? Can you do that? So Jake, you what's going on?
It's good for pollinating. Oh,
did we turn on?
I would leave the weed. That's good for pollinators. We should let that keep growing. It's good to be natural.
I mean, that's true, and I've just been slammed. You know, I've been taking the dogs have been really bad out on the walks, and they're too busy, so I got to just keep moving. It is nasty, though. I hope somebody takes care of it.
Well, I'm at school, and I don't have any weed killers, so, like, I can't just like go pick it up. I can't like drive all the way here to go get it. So yeah, it's.
That makes sense. I mean, it's hard to do that.
Okay, the next week, the plant is taking over the parking lot. You can't park in this spot anymore.
Well, that's why we have spots on the street. Oh.
Yeah, you know, I'm lucky. I just walked to church. So.
I mean, like, me too, but I think, like, someone else could probably get it. Like, it's not really my problem. I don't even go over there, really, so it's, like, fine.
Okay, so next week, the weed is so high that there are children beginning to climb on it.
Someone ought to put a sign out here. Like, we should, I don't know, we should email someone on church staff or somebody and say, somebody ought to do something about this.
I mean, I think it's great. I mean, it's an extra playground. We've been talking about new equipment. So, I mean, good for them. They're what a creative bunch of kids.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's great. And I also don't have kids. So, like, it's like, not, someone else can handle that.
That's good, that's good. Okay, so the weed is not taken care of. The weed is sitting there and eventually dies, right? Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe it takes over the whole church in the end. So, okay, let's give them a round of applause for helping us out. So, okay. So if you didn't know, Pastor Chris has a thing for weeds growing. If you do see a weed, please pick. Yeah, there was one literally over the gathering place. It got like this high. I'm like, who's going to pick it, right? Along this. But think about it. Diffusion of responsibility. We fail to act because we think, that's not my problem. That's somebody else's problem. Somebody else is going to do it. I see somebody like crying in the church foyer, like so-and-so's closer friends with them. I'm busy. I got to go along, right? We see something that, hey, it's a lot of people's fault, but it's not me. You know, on a bigger level, we allow things to just happen and to go along with it. We allow things like racism, sexism, poverty as, hey, everybody is responsible, but I'm really not responsible for that. I don't participate in that, so I don't have to do anything about it. So we don't act. And you think about this. In either case, though, pluralistic ignorance when we go with the crowd or diffusion of responsibility, we fail to act because we don't see it as our problem. That the situation's the same. We think it's enough to just not do wrong. We think it's enough to just not do wrong. Now, whatever the reason, I know when I look back at things in my own life, I tend to see so many instances when I had the opportunity to do something, and yet I didn't. You know, there's times when I gave up on someone or something, when I've washed my hands of the situation because it was just too dirty, too messy, I don't have time, I don't want to be there. You know, how many times have we sat in a room? Maybe people are sharing negative opinions, but we go along with it. How many times have we seen a person and decided, no, it's their fault that's the way they are, I wasn't involved with it, so therefore I am not going to help. Or times that we think that somebody else should do something about that weed. Somebody else, right? I see the trash. I see the grocery cart. I see the person in trouble. I see the accident. I just assume somebody else will take care of it. But God gives us the opportunity to act all the time. But for many reasons, we fail to do what we ought to do. We hide behind the fact that we didn't do anything wrong. We think, you know, it's too big. There's nothing I can do. But how often do we overestimate the cost of acting but underestimate the cost of doing nothing at all? And that's what I really wonder about Jesus before Pilate. You know, some Christians would say, well, God had this all planned, and God was moving people like puppets, and God made them act this way, made Pilate do that. And I would disagree with that. I would dare to say, I think instead, God allowed them. God let them. That God knew our tendency, knows our tendency, our nature, to serve ourselves. And Jesus shows us that what happens when we decide to wash our hands of uncomfortable things and when we fail to address sin and hate and what becomes of it. So when you think about it, Jesus' death sentence is really the outcome of humanity having our way, preserving our own power, blaming others, and preferring violence just to get what we want. It's ironic that Mark's account here is not so much a trial about Jesus But his intent is to put us on trial. See, we're the ones on trial. We're the people on trial. And of course, all of us are found guilty for standing by too often, for washing our hands of situations that God is calling us to act in. And like I said, this is a hard message. It's a hard message for me. Where does that leave us then, right? Well, I think the first appropriate response to this story is first our confession to God and to recognize the times that we have failed to do the right thing. The times we have washed our hands or walked away. The times that we've not my problem, not my thing. That's their fault. That's not, I'm going to not be involved with it. To confess to God that sometimes we've been more like the crowd or religious leaders. We've been more like Pilate than we care to admit. The first step is to confess it. What darkness do you see in your soul? Where have you done nothing? But the second thing is this, that no matter what we've done or what we have not done in the past, we always have an opportunity in the present. We always do. Now is always an opportunity to do something that when we do see it the next time, we are not gonna be the ones to wash our hands and walk away. A friend of mine sent me a little story that took place in his life recently. I write this Lenten devotion. Some of you all get that. People around the country and places have been doing this for like about 15 years now, every Lenten season. And one of the stories that I shared was about second chances and how God gives second chances. And he was telling me this. He said, when we were just standing, Chris, we were standing in line at the grocery store, a few people ahead, and there was a lady having trouble covering her bill for her groceries. Credit card declined, pulled crumpled bills out of her wallet, finally pay for her bill. I felt the Holy Spirit and Julie nudge me to take her bill, and I chickened out. All that night, I was convicted. I missed a clear opportunity to serve God. I did nothing. I could hear God say, come on, man, I called you. Well, the very next day, we went to lunch at a new place, and guess who our waitress was? God gave me a second chance to help this lady, and I didn't miss obeying the second time. God's a God of second chances. And friends, let's not live our lives with regrets of the things that we have not done. It's easy to say it's too hard, it's too big, it's too complicated, I'm gonna look silly, it's too risky, I don't wanna be the only one, I'm too scared, it's not my problem. But I want you to remember that sometimes the cause of Christ dies, not because a few people do the wrong thing, but because a lot of decent people fail to do the right thing. Let's pray.